opening narration.
Akhotra Foundation presents the Akhotra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI.
Introduction.
Okay, so today we're doing a deep dive into, well, a really powerful and honestly quite painful story. It's based around Jonathan Rosen's book, The Best Minds.
Yeah, it's a heavy one. It follows Rosen's friendship with Michael Laudor, two incredibly bright guys.
Exceptionally bright. But it's also about how that friendship and Michael's life got caught up in this myth, the myth of the recovered genius.
And that's really why it's still so significant, isn't it? It's about mental illness, yes, but also about the stories we tell ourselves, the heroes we want.
And what happens when a real person struggling with a real illness gets crushed under the weight of being that kind of symbol?
Exactly. It forces us to look at, you know, not just individual tragedy, but systemic failures in mental health care, and maybe even in our own need for simple narratives.
It really makes you think about how society consumes stories of recovery. So let's unpack this.
The chronological journey.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Jonathan Rosen and Michael Laudor. They grew up together in New Rochelle, New York. This is back in the 70s and 80s.
Right. Affluent backgrounds, academic families, Jewish households where, you know, intellect was really highly prized.
Immensely. And the sources really paint this picture of an intense friendship, a kind of intellectual rivalry, but also deep affection.
Especially towards Michael, right? He sounds almost otherworldly in his brilliance. Rosen describes him speaking in these fully formed, complex paragraphs, even as a kid.
Yeah, incandescent is a word that comes up, just dazzling. And Rosen had this line, something like, loving Michael meant loving the part of him that was better than you.
Wow, that says a lot about the dynamic. Intense. Yeah,
very. And this shared brilliance, this focus on the mind, it led them to develop this philosophy they called intellectual absolutism.
Okay, what did that entail, basically?
Well, the core belief was that the mind is supreme. That, you know, through sheer force of intellect, logic, and will, you could understand and overcome pretty much anything. Any challenge, even the messiness of the human psyche itself.
A powerful idea, especially for two young, brilliant minds. But also, maybe a dangerous one.
Potentially, yeah. Because what happens when the mind itself is the thing that's struggling? For a while, though, especially at Yale, Michael's intensity, it was almost rewarded.
People saw it as, what, just part of his genius? Like a tax you pay for being that smart?
Kind of, yeah. Maybe some subtle paranoia, obsessive thinking.
Yeah.
It was easy to explain away in that hyper-competitive environment. But then came the first major break.
After college.
Yeah, he was in this high-powered consulting job, and he had a full psychotic breakdown, just completely shattered that mind-over-matter idea.
And the diagnosis.
Severe schizophrenia. He ended up hospitalized, institutionalized for a time. I mean, this wasn't just a setback. It fundamentally challenged his entire identity, that core belief in the all-powerful intellect.
The very thing that made him him.
Exactly. It suggested his greatest strength was compromised. And that that failure, that confrontation with biological reality really sets the stage for everything that follows.
Core philosophy and values.
So that core philosophy, intellectual absolutism.
Yeah.
It really defined their early years, this belief in the mind's power.
It absolutely did. It was their driving force. The idea was, if you could think clearly, rigorously, you could master not just external problems, but your internal world too.
Control your destiny through intellect.
Right. Success was about mental strength. Failure, maybe a lack of sufficient willpower or clear thinking. Purpose was tied to intellectual achievement, to understanding, to mastering complexity.
And you can see how appealing that would be. But life, especially with severe mental illness, isn't always logical, is it?
Not at all. And that's the tragic tension. Michael's core value system, his entire sense of self-worth, was built on this foundation that his own biology was starting to undermine.
So his driving force became intertwined with his biggest struggle.
Three pivotal turning points.
Okay, so after the breakdown and hospitalization, you'd think the story might go one way. But then comes this absolutely stunning turn. This is the first really pivotal moment.
He applies to Yale Law School.
Yeah, from like a halfway house, basically. And he gets in. It's almost unbelievable.
And he doesn't hide his history.
No, that's the key. He uses it. He frames his experience with psychosis and institutionalization as giving him unique insight, you know, a perspective others lacked, a battle fought, and seemingly won.
And people responded to that.
Oh, absolutely. The world was ready for that story, which leads to the second turning point, the media explosion.
The New York Times piece.
Exactly. 1995, front page, A Voyage to Bedlam and Partway Back. Suddenly, He's not just a promising law student. He's a national symbol. Hope, resilience, the power of the mind triumphing over illness.
He becomes the poster child for recovery.
Instantly. And that fame, that symbolic weight, leads directly to the third turning point.
Yeah.
A commodification of his story.
The movie deal.
Yeah. Ron Howard's company, Imagine Entertainment, a reported $1.5 million deal for his life rights. Talk of Brad Pitt playing him.
Wow. That's enormous pressure. That cements the myth, doesn't it? It makes the story into a product.
Completely. He's no longer just Michael Laudor, a person dealing with a chronic serious illness. He's now the recovered genius's brand. His value is tied entirely to performing that role.
And performing that role 24/7.
It became unbearable. The myth required him to be constantly brilliant, articulate, seemingly cured. There was just no room for the actual reality of schizophrenia, the ups and downs, the ongoing struggle.
And to be that brilliant person for the book deal for the movie, he needed his mind sharp.
Which led him to do something incredibly dangerous. He started lowering his medication because the side effects, you know, the dullness, the cognitive slowing, they interfered with the brilliance the myth demanded.
Oh, man. So the very thing created to celebrate his recovery pushed him to undermine the stability that made any kind of recovery possible. A trap.
A lethal trap. The need to fulfill the public fiction directly led to the unraveling of his private reality. And that unraveling, it was catastrophic.
The final act, the murder of Carrie Costello.
Yes, his fiancée, pregnant at the time, also a brilliant advocate herself. He killed her during a psychotic episode fueled by paranoid delusions. June 17th, 1998. The inspiring story just imploded into horror.
Human lessons and reflection.
Just devastating. And you mentioned Rosen's guilt, the feeling that love wasn't enough. But the book argues this wasn't just a personal failure, right? There were bigger systems involved.
Absolutely. That's crucial. If we connect this to the bigger picture, you see these glaring systemic failures. First, the whole issue of deinstitutionalization.
Closing the big state hospitals, which sounded good in theory.
Right. Many were awful places. Yeah. But the idea was to replace them with robust community care, assertive, sustained treatment in the community. And that, well, it mostly didn't happen. Or not nearly enough.
But so people with severe mental illness were often left without adequate support. Kind of abandoned.
Pretty much. Left to a fragmented, underfunded system. Or to families who weren't equipped. Or to the streets or prisons. So that's one huge failure. The lack of adequate community resources.
Okay. And the second failure?
Legal obstacles. This is really tricky. Laws designed to protect civil liberties, to prevent people from being unfairly locked up.
Which are important laws.
Very important. But in Michael's case, they became a barrier to getting him help when he was clearly spiraling because he was so intelligent, so articulate, a Yale law student.
He could argue his way out of involuntary commitment. He could mask his symptoms.
Exactly. He knew the language of rights. He could present himself as competent, even when friends and family could see he was deeply unwell and becoming dangerous. His brilliance, the very thing that made him the recovered genius, became a tool his illness used to resist treatment.
That is chilling. The system designed to protect him, in a way, enabled the tragedy.
It's a terrible paradox. And it points to this fundamental confusion that Rosen really wants us, the readers, you listening now, to grasp. It's the failure to distinguish between the mind and the brain.
Okay, explain that distinction. It sounds critical.
It is. Everyone involved, friends, family, the media, maybe even Michael himself at times, wanted to believe this was a problem of the mind, something that could be overcome with willpower, with narrative, with intellectual strength, like fixing faulty software.
They wanted the inspiring story.
They wanted the inspiring story. But schizophrenia isn't fundamentally a mind problem in that sense. It's a disease of the brain. It's a biological, neurological condition. It's like a hardware problem.
And you can't fix a hardware problem just by rewriting the software or, you know, thinking harder.
Precisely. They were applying intellectual solutions to a biological illness, prioritizing the story, the narrative of mental triumph over the messy, difficult medical reality of brain disease. And that disconnect, that failure to see it primarily as a medical issue requiring consistent biological treatment, that was catastrophic.
That distinction is. Yeah, that's the gut punch, isn't it? Mind versus brain. So why does this story, rooted in the 90s, elite institutions, why does it matter to us now? Why should you, listening today, care?
Because, well, the pressure Michael faced hasn't vanished. If anything, it's become universalized. Think about it. The pressure to perform, to curate a perfect image, to narrate your life as a story of constant progress and resilience.
It's everywhere now. Social media, the wellness industry.
Exactly. Michael was like an analog prototype for the digital age. We're all encouraged, sometimes pressured, to present this polished version of ourselves. Vulnerability is okay, but usually only if it fits into a neat redemption arc. The recovered geniuses myth is alive and well, just maybe repackaged as the thriving influencer or the resilient entrepreneur.
We still crave those simple, uplifting stories, even if reality is much more complex and sometimes, frankly, requires unglamorous long-term medical management, not just willpower.
Right. We still haven't fully reckoned with the biological basis of severe mental illness, and we still often prioritize inspiring narratives over difficult truths. Rosen's book is a warning about the very real, sometimes lethal, cost of that preference.
Three final takeaways.
Okay, so let's try and distill this down. If someone takes away just three things from this deep dive, what should they be? Let's start with an emotional insight.
I think the most powerful emotional lesson here is about the limits of love. It's the acceptance that sometimes love and the very best intentions, they just aren't enough to conquer a severe biological illness like schizophrenia.
That's hard to accept. We're told love conquers all.
We are. But realizing its limits isn't a failure of love. It's actually a kind of difficult wisdom. It means understanding that sometimes the most loving thing you can do is support consistent medical care, even when it's not romantic or inspiring. Love provides the scaffolding, but it can't rebuild a biologically compromised foundation on its own.
Okay, so acceptance of limitation. What about an intellectual insight?
That definitely has to be the mind versus brain distinction we talked about. The core intellectual takeaway is recognizing the trap of focusing only on the mind, the narrative, the willpower, the personality, when dealing with the disease of the brain.
Michael was celebrated for mastering his mind.
Exactly, while his brain remained ill. The intellectual error was prioritizing the story we wanted to hear, the triumph of will over the medical reality that needed consistent biological treatment. Rosen's line nails it. We'd all wanted to leave a story about the mind, but this was a story about the brain. That's the key insight.
Right, mind is the story, brain is the biology. Got it. And finally, a universal insight, something applicable beyond this specific story.
I think it's the danger of the perfect story itself. The universal lesson is about the need to resist reducing complex human beings and situations to simple, neat narratives, especially redemptive ones.
Whether it's about mental health or our own lives or politics.
Exactly. We need to make space for messiness, for imperfection, for the truths that don't fit a clean arc. Sometimes the most helpful, most honest thing we can do is abandon the demand for a perfect, inspiring story and just grapple with a complicated, often difficult reality. Embracing that complexity is crucial.
Closing narration.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.